Welcome to the Republican Professor. I'm your host, Dr. Lucas J. Mather. Today is 30 July, 2025 years after Jesus, and we're coming to you from Southern California, allegedly still in the United States of America, at least nominally, if not realistically. And we're in the wonderful journey through the swirly twirly gumdrops of Richard A. Epstein's book, Takings, Private Property and the Power of Eminent Domain, published by Harvard University Press, 1985. This is a series we're doing on the Republican Professor podcast, honoring the 40th anniversary of the publication of this wonderful book. We're in chapter three today. Chapter three is entitled The Integrity of the Constitutional Text. And we'd like to thank Richard A. Epstein for writing it. We'd like to thank Harvard University Press for publishing it and for making this available. We're going to make a fair use of this material and do a transformative reading. It's not for profit. It's for the education of anyone willing to undergo the arduous journey of a Republican Professor podcast episode. And I think even our discussions with some of our eminent guests have been, you know, something you have to kind of slog through, because it's all relevant, not only relevant, but accurate and insightful, thick material that is a wonderful basis for sound public policy and activist engagement, all wrapped up into one. Praise the Lord. By the way, praise the Lord for this country that we get to enjoy the freedom to do this. And we think of all those people, not only now, but in history, who have not had the opportunities afforded to us to engage civically and to take responsibility for the future of our communities and to give back to the next generation. So thank you, Richard A. Epstein, for writing this book, Takings, Private Property and the Power of Eminent Domain. Again, we're going to use a fair use, transformed reading. We'd like to thank Harvard University Press for making this book available. Please support Harvard University Press. Let's reward them for publishing this book. I would encourage you to go to Harvard University Press's catalog, buy anything by Richard A. Epstein and or Philip Hamburger. The burdens of constitutional interpretation. The political speculations, Richard A. Epstein says on page 19, at the middle there, beginning this chapter called The Integrity of Constitutional Text, chapter three. The political speculations of Hobbes and Locke bore fruit in our own Constitution with its elaborate network of procedural and substantive provisions. The formulation of government in accordance with a particular outlook, however, marks only the first stage in the long journey to sound governance. The second stage is to preserve the political arrangements that the Constitution ordains. In this country, the preservation of I guess I need new glasses. The preservation of institutional arrangements rests in large measure upon the theory of separation of powers in ways that neither Locke nor Montesquieu quite foresaw. Well, you got my attention there, Richard. The institution of judicial review divides the power to make laws between legislatures and the courts in accordance with a simple but powerful plan. The legislature alone has the power to initiate legislation, but the court, even though it cannot legislate, can strike down that legislation. The eminent domain clause, in particular, commands courts to strike down legislation where property is taken, but just compensation is not paid. All right. Thank you for that, Richard. That's a lot there. The power of judicial review. Well, let's think about that for a second. And I know some of you guys are thinking, what is he resting that microphone on? The thought that this would be a paid sponsor is laughable. It's not a paid sponsor, but I'll show you the books. Red Cocaine. Red Cocaine by Douglas, Joseph D. Douglas. What's that about? It's about communist use of drugs to make Americans stupid. Stupid. And what's underneath that? Because that's just a thin book. And you'll notice this is like a first edition. Good luck finding this one. This one is The Black Book of Communism, published by Backwoods Bible Press. Backwoods Bible Press in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Oh, sorry, Harvard University Press. I'm sorry, I got that wrong. The Black Book of Communism, Crimes, Terror, Repression. How many pages are in this book? Oh, you know, about 800 pages of Crimes, Terror, Repression. Published by Harvard University Press about the leftism, which is what we're countering here on the Republican Professor podcast. That's what we do. That's our MO. That's my job. And Richard, thank you for helping us because this is very helpful. And thank you, Harvard University Press, for publishing the Black Book of Communism. Go check out Harvard University Press's catalog and buy it. Support your local book dealer if you want to get a used copy. Okay. All right. Let's keep going. The institution of judicial review, in turn, places enormous demands upon the rules of constitutional interpretation. Yeah. Judges who serve on good behavior, which typically means for life, typically. I guess that makes sense, right? Can nullify the decision of elected officials even though they themselves are not elected. If the power of the judges is to be legitimated, they cannot be just another political organ of government. As they cannot appeal to popular will, they must be able to provide authoritative interpretations of the constitutional text that are not simply manifestations of their own private beliefs about what legislation should accomplish. Incidentally, this is typically what is meant when you hear a federal judge or a law professor or something say policy, the word policy instead of law. It's supposed to put law. This is ironic. It's supposed to put law, which the judges are interpreting and applying. Outside the bounds of public, well, outside the bounds of their private preference, as if the word policy is a word for private preference. It's a little bit confusing the way those terms are used. I'll be forthright with you, just letting you know that scholars and judges are not always clear about words they throw around. Just like average everyday Americans are not always clear when they throw around words like conservative or liberal or something like that. So just be on the lookout. We want to try to clarify as much as possible what these words mean that we throw around. So I would like you to check out a video that I did last year on what is right, what is left. That's an attempt at trying to clarify what those terms mean. It's one option. In order for judges to make principal interpretations, the language of the Constitution must be clear and precise enough to bind even those who disagree with it, what it says. For the mission of constitutional government must soon founder if judges can decide cases as freely with the Constitution in place as without it. Page 20 at the top. The power of language to bind the judicial will is tested in the limit by many of the central provisions of the Constitution. The eminent domain clause contains a set of terms that are not defined in the Constitution itself: private property, taken, just compensation, and public use. The contracts, due process, equal protection, establishment, and freedom of speech clauses all contain the most common and difficult terms in our legal lexicon, linked together in sentences of great power, but of equally great abstraction. The community of understanding that lends meaning to the Constitution comes of necessity from outside the text. In the way these words are used in ordinary discourse by persons who are educated in the normal social and cultural discourse of their own time. We're still in philosophical preliminaries in Richard A. Epstein's book, Takings, Private Property and the Power of Eminent Domain, published by Harvard University Press, 1985. We're on page 20 in the middle. Let me know what you guys think about this in the comments. I picked the power of eminent domain because it doesn't get talked about. It's not a sexy topic for media, but it's all over the place. And indeed, I would say it gets to the heart of some very serious political fights that we have in America, and we always have had. It's not just America, frickin' any country has this fight. Any country. We're going through the Chevron deference doctrine deep dive, and that whole thing is about takings. That whole thing. The last episode we did about, taxing fishermen 200 miles off the coast of the United States. How is that not a taking? That's why I'm doing the Chevron deference deep dive. You guys following this? Gonna have a drink of some green tea. All right, let's get into this. Vagueness in perspective. It is often said that this standard of ordinary language is simply too vague to permit any consensus to be reached on the meaning of difficult texts. Thomas Gray has argued forcefully that in ordinary discourse, the term private property has no uniform meaning. Gray notes that in some instances, property refers to real estate. In other contexts, it refers to rights, good against the world, as opposed to rights against particular persons under contract. Property can refer to a remedy of restoration or an injunction, as opposed to damages. Still, other accounts of property are result-oriented. It can be regarded as a means to promote allocative efficiency or to protect individual security and independence. And most instructively, Gray notes that property can refer to the different set of rights protected against the government takeover under the eminent domain clause. Having set out the possible permutations of the term, he concludes that it is not of much value at all. Here's a quotation from that guy, Thomas Gray. The conclusion of all this is that discourse about property has fragmented into a set of discontinuous usages. Tell us more, Mr. Gray. The more fruitful and useful of these usages are those stipulated by theorists, but these depart, I'm on page 21 at the top, drastically from each other and from common speech. Conversely, meanings of property in the law that cling to their origin in the thing ownership conception are integrated least successfully into the general doctrinal framework of law, legal theory, and economics. It seems fair to conclude from a glance at the range of current usages, this is still Thomas Gray, that the specialists who design and manipulate legal structures of the advanced capitalist economies could easily do without using the term property at all. I'm on page 21 at the top, that's the end of that quotation. Here's Richard A. Epstein again. Try it. The great vice in Gray's argument is that it fosters an unwarranted intellectual skepticism, if not despair. He rejects a term that has well-nigh universal usage in the English language because of some inevitable tensions in its meaning, but he suggests nothing of consequence to take its place. I love Richard. He defends common sense. That's why I like Richard Epstein. Good job, Richard. Keep going. Eliminate the sense of the term private property, and it becomes easy to knock out the constitutional pillars that support the institution, thereby expanding both the size and discretionary power of government. Do you see how philosophy can be used to try to increase the power of government? And I know that some skeptic out there is going to say, yeah, but you're using philosophy to try to limit the power of government. Well, yeah, I like C.S. Lewis said, good philosophy must exist to counter at least bad philosophy. That's true. But we have to start somewhere, and I prefer to start with common sense. Maybe we're off to the races in defining what that is, but Richard is clearly in the right that the term private property is in widespread usage. There is a clear meaning to the term in common sense. Let's try to get at what that is. There is, however, no reason, this is Richard again, to give up on language at the first sign of difficulty. A far superior approach to the problem is set out by Hannah Pitkin in her excellent study, The Concept of Representation. One key passage deserves to be quoted at some length. Yeah, quote that to us, Richard. Why don't you quote that to us, buddy? I want to hear it. Quote it to us. All right. Let's hear what this lady has to say. So one key passage deserves to be quoted at some length because it well captures the proper attitude toward interpretive efforts. Here's the quotation from Hannah Pitkin. The confused state of representation theory does not seem to me a cause for despair. Nor do I think we should abandon the concept that it lacks fixed meaning, is vague, or differs in regard from our other concepts. It is used in various senses and different connections, but it does not follow that the word can be correctly used in various senses in any given connection. In a particular context, the appropriate use of the word may be obligatory. A varied usage is not the same thing as a vague usage. Quite the opposite. The need for making distinctions is exactly contrary to the vagueness which results from failure to distinguish. In that case, however, the problem is not to state the correct meaning of the word, but to specify all the varieties of its application to various contexts. Continuing in the quote, thus my first working assumption has been that representation does have an identifiable meaning. I guess that's good for us because we're a representative republic, right? Representative democracy. Applied in different but controlled and discoverable ways in different contexts. It is not vague and shifting, but a single, highly complex concept that has not, next page, changed much in its basic meaning since the 17th century. There is indeed no great difficulty about formulating a one-sentence definition of this basic meaning, broad enough to cover all its applications in various contexts. Several commentators have done so, and in that sense, one correct definition can be singled out. Representation means, as the word's etymological origin suggests, a representation of making present again. Except in its earliest use, however, this has always meant more than a literal bringing into presence, as one might bring a book into the room. Rather, representation, taken generally, means the making present in some sense of something which is nevertheless not present literally or in fact. Makes sense to me. We're on page 22 at the top. That's the end of that quotation. Here's Richard A. Epstein again. The same conceptual approach can be taken with the term private property, which so troubles Gray. Its basic sense can be well captured, notwithstanding the network of meanings that surround its use. Consider Blackstone's definition as commentaries. There's nothing which so generally strikes the imagination and engages the affections of mankind as the right of property. That's Blackstone. Or that sole and despotic dominion which one man claims and exercises over the external things of the world in total exclusion of the right of any other individual in the universe. That's the end of the Blackstone quotation. Did you see that? Private property has to do with exclusion, right? Let's say you own a parking space. This is me. Let's say that you own a parking space, as in when you have a house and you have a driveway. And someone comes and parks in front of the driveway or inside of the driveway. Let's just make it clear, inside the driveway. And we had this issue just recently in recent months. I went outside in the middle of the night and there was somebody parked in our driveway. You might wonder, why the hell would somebody do that? Well, in Orange County, the cities here in Orange County, it's very common for the local officials to enact ordinances making it an infraction to park on the street during certain hours of the night. It's really frustrating, but the public officials claim ownership of the public streets, and they claim to be able to do this. And so those people who don't have a driveway to park in at night face a ticket possibly every night for parking on the street at night. And the tickets are not inconsequential. They're, I think, $39 or something like that, $42. Now, they don't enforce it every night, but I have seen it enforced as much as once a week for periods of time. And so there's a tremendous incentive to avoid this ticket and notice various sleepy locations in the cities that have driveways, and you risk upsetting the person there, but you just try not to let them know. Well, this person apparently didn't think anybody was going to come out in the middle of the night and look at the driveway, which I did, and sometimes I do. Not because I'm looking for people parking in the driveway, but because I just keep a watch on the neighborhood. And I take a very powerful flashlight out there with me, and I do a walk around for about 45 seconds or so. Sometimes I don't do it as often as I used to, but I do it on occasion. And this time I caught this person, and it wasn't the first time. So I wrote a note very strenuously pointing out that the person would be towed. Hasn't happened again, at least from that person. But all that to say that the idea of property per se, private or public, has to do with exclusion, the right to exclude. And in this case, I just gave you an example of both and where they're coming into conflict with the average people who don't have a driveway. The local officials claim the power to exclude residents from the public streets during certain hours of the night. And the penalty for disobeying the exclusion order is a taking of private property in the form of payment to the local authority. And I gave an example of private property where the driveways in the neighborhood are private property. And now all of a sudden, people are being squeezed out of the public property and into the private properties, lest they be a victim of the public taking. So that's a live issue, and it has to do with a very commonsensical idea. Not just of private property, I'm adding to what Richard was saying, but property itself, public and private. Because what we have here is a war, if you want to put it that way, a conflict between private and public property. The public actors, which are individual people, are claiming to take private property for the benefit of the public. It works the same way. Am I right or am I right? Or am I right or am I right or am I right? Know what I mean, Vern? All right, where are we at? We finished the Blackstone quotation. Elsewhere, Blackstone elaborated on the rights implicit in the ownership of property. Here's another quotation from Blackstone. The third absolute right inherent in every Englishman is that of property, which consists in the free use, enjoyment, and disposal of all his acquisitions without any control or diminution save only by the laws of the land. Blackstone sought to understand what ordinary words mean, and the definition he offered holds open the possibility of future elaboration. Moreover, his definition is powerful enough to overcome all of Gray's counterarguments in exactly the way that Pitkin indicates. Thus, it is no rebuke to the Blackstone definition that real estate is one of the most important forms of private property, that property can be set in opposition to contract, or that violations of property rights sometimes result in an award of damages and sometimes in an injunction. Indeed, each of these areas can be studied in great detail, as is done throughout this book. Now we're on page 23 at the top. I'm just going to take a look at these footnotes really quick again. Okay, Blackstone commentaries. There's a law in the law of the land. Okay, I'm going to ignore that one for now. Nor do the multiple purposes that private property serves prevent us from understanding the meaning of the phrase. Private property could serve the ends of allocative efficiency and of personal security and independence. It is likely that it serves both, and that these turn out to be highly interdependent. Similarly, Blackstone's definition does not preclude, but in fact facilitates, the social and economic forms of ownership of the advanced capitalist state. The condominium and the corporation are created by the repeated use of the rights of disposition that are inherent in private property, rights that are transferred and not lost by their exercise. The protean ways in which vested entitlements can be recombined show the flexibility, not the unintelligibility, of the institution of private property. Page 23. I'm enjoying this. I hope you are too. So we're dealing with the issue of, can we even understand what the word means, private property? That's a preliminary philosophical issue, of course, because if you can't understand what it means, then how can the Constitution protect it? And so it's a nice foray into the question of what this word means, right? We all use the term. And I would say it's not just private property. Again, it's property per se, public and private. After all, the Smithsonian closes at night, right? They claim to be able to exclude you from that public property. Let's continue. We'll go a little bit further here. Okay. All right, let's continue. Can you see the book? Zoom is having a wonderful time. Zoom is a, I don't know. Are you Democrat, Zoom? Are you a Democrat company? I don't know. But I'm going to just read. I hope you don't mind. I'm reading, man. I don't need to look at you to read. I'm reading. Most important for this inquiry, Blackstone's account of private property explains what the term means in the eminent domain clause. Okay. He's throwing down the gauntlet. He's a Blackstone guy. He loves Blackstone. A constitution that wishes to protect private property must take the meaning of private property from ordinary usage. Sounds good to me. Gray does not offer any definition of the term that can begin to rival. Yeah, that's true. Blackstone's incompleteness, universality, and relevance. Let's get that definition again from Blackstone. I'm going to go back to that quotation. There is nothing, this is Blackstone, there is nothing which so generally strikes the imagination and engages the affections of mankind as the right of property, nor that sole and despotic dominion which one man claims and exercises over the external things of the world in total exclusion of the right of any other individual in the universe. What does that mean? It means when you own something, other people are excluded from using it. And it could be that's my pen, that's my pocket knife, that's my bike, that's my sweater, that's my whatever. You know, that's my parking space, that's my bed. Don't take a nap in it when I'm gone. You know, I mean, when we're asleep at night, just because we're not using that space on the driveway doesn't mean we have given up the right to exclude other people. And it's the same with public property, right? The government claims to be able to exclude people from its property based on its rules, right? I mean that there is a crime of trespass on government property, right? There is a crime of that. Well, the only way they can do that is the right to exclude. Now, real estate is one example, but it goes down to even like a writing utensil or something. You know, I mean, typically, depending on the object you're claiming as property, people take it more or less serious, but the principle is the same, is what Richard is saying, and that's what Blackstone is saying. Here's the rest of that Blackstone quote. The third absolute right inherent in every Englishman is that of property, which consists in the free use, enjoyment, and disposal of all his acquisitions without any control or diminution, save only by the laws of the land. You know, that issue of the laws of the land seems to be a qualification on the right of property. And maybe I should get into that footnote because there's a footnote about the law of the land aspect of that. And I'm going to read that part again. The third absolute right, this is Blackstone, inherent in every Englishman is that of property, which consists in the free use. So if I own a pen, it's mine to use freely. If it's not your pen, you have no claim to it. That's a dumb example, maybe, but I'm giving you one where the principle is the same, right? If I'm walking around wearing my clothes, you don't have a right to wear them. And that right that you don't have extends to even when I'm not wearing them. So it's not, in other words, you don't have a right to come in my home and rifle through my dresser drawers because I'm not using those clothes. It has nothing to do with use. It has to do with exclusion. The property's mine. You are excluded unless I give you permission. And again, I'm adding, I think this is the fifth time I've said it, that this is property per se. It's not just private property. It goes for public as well. Public property. Okay, the laws of the land issue. Here's a footnote six. Some question could be raised about Blackstone's meaning given the last clause on the law of the land. Is this right of property really conditioned on the laws of the land? Because what could go wrong if a legislature wakes up on the wrong side of the bed one morning and says, private property can be qualified any damn way we want today? Is there any natural limitation on what the legislature can do? And I think that's what he's asking. But its meaning seems to have been, this is footnote six again, but its meaning seems to have been only that regular procedures had to be used to deprive an individual of property, that extraordinary ad hoc procedures could not substitute for adjudication. Oh, that's helpful. I like that it's not ad hoc, but it makes little sense to read the passage as saying that property was held at the grace of the legislature, even in a system that holds open just that possibility because of the growth of the parliamentary supremacy, a development not completed in Blackstone's day. And I would also add, that's the end of the footnote. I would also add that it was parliamentary supremacy was a major fear of the framers of the Constitution, which you could read about in the Federalist Papers. Take a look at the mid-40s to early 50s of the Federalist Papers, especially 47, 48, 49, 50, 51. Okay? It's all there. You can take a look, and I would suggest you use the Signet Classic Edition, edited with introduction by Charles R. Kessler, a guest on this podcast, and my professor for the PhD course on the Federalist Papers that I took. The reason I like that edition is because there's page numbers collating each Federalist paper with the text of the Constitution that it's defending. So that you can go back in the back in the appendix and you can look at the text of the Constitution, you'll see the page numbers of the Federalists that discuss that part. It's great. Okay, let's do a little bit more and then we'll go have some ice cream. Where'd I leave off? Where did I leave off? This too close? Is it too loud? Okay. Seems like it's not very loud. Maybe it's because my voice is not loud. I don't know. Okay, here we go. Okay. Gray. Most important for this inquiry, I'm just going to read that paragraph again on page 23. Most important for this inquiry, Blackstone's account of private property explains what the term means in the eminent domain clause. A constitution that wishes to protect private property must take the meaning of private property from ordinary usage. Let me translate a little bit there. What Richard is saying is, we're not skeptics in epistemology. We're common sense realists. We're using a critical realism. We have to start somewhere. We're starting with common usage. We're starting with common sense. Gray does not offer any. Gray is the skeptic that he quoted earlier. Gray does not offer any definition of the term that can begin to rival Blackstone's in completeness, universality, and relevance. Gray wishes to rid the English language of a central term, but he provides nothing in its place for constitutional discourse. Following this wonderful prescription would lead to the ruination of constitutional protections of freedom of speech, press, religion. Am I too close? Well, religion. and association. What about arms, Richard? What about arms? These words are difficult to understand as well, especially when social decisions hinge on them. It follows that in constitutional inquiry, the question of vagueness must, as Pitkin notes, be kept in proper perspective. This is a very interesting question in the philosophy of language as it pertains to law. To be sure, there are difficult cases in the application of any concept, especially one as pervasive as private property. Occasionally, it is close to impossible to determine whether A or B is the owner of land. A's occupation is prior to B's, but B has fenced first. A's deed may be first in time, but B's deed may be first recorded. Of course, what's a deed? And who has a right to give a deed? You see how foundational these issues are in government? Yeah. Incidentally, why are we using English sources? We're using the English language. So the history of the English language is very important here. We go back to, some Roman influences, Anglo-Saxon, Norman, possibly, all contributed to the English language development and legal customs that arose in the colonies. And the colonies are the immediate precursors of the states, the United States, and the people that wrote the constitutions of the several states, as well as the Declaration of Independence, as well as the disastrous Articles of Confederation. But they're also the same group that overturned the Articles of Confederation with all of its problems and created the U.S. Constitution and ratified, for example, the Second Amendment. Yeah. We're going to do a little bit more of this, and then we're going to go get some ice cream. Occasionally, well, to be sure, there are difficult cases in the application of any concept, especially one as pervasive as private property. Occasionally, it is close to impossible to determine whether A or B is the owner of land. A's occupation is prior to B's. B has fenced first. A's deed may be first in time, but B's deed may be first recorded. That's all. I mean, you could give tons of examples in English history where that exact thing took place. As in the Anglo-Saxon Wars, for example. The Anglo-Saxon wars against the Vikings, for example, who took over vast territories in England for a long time. And by the way, that serves as kind of a basis for J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings stuff, because he was a scholar of that period. And so, the rise of the monasteries in Anglo-Saxon England, for example, the rise of the cathedral monastery, the monastic cathedral, which is almost totally unheard of in Western Christianity. Those, monasteries and stuff had land, and they were centers of learning, not just worship, but learning. Remember, there were no universities back then. This is before Oxford and Cambridge. It was before Aberdeen. It was before St. Andrews, the four medieval universities. The monasteries were really the loci of learning, and then the royal households sometimes would be, not to mention thugs like Vikings and other thugs, would confiscate land. And so the issue of title was a live issue in English history. And it might be hard to contemplate, but you get the idea if you just think hard enough about it, you do a little research, think about it a little bit, you know? Yet the greater danger is an acute attack of lawyer's disease. Marginal cases are the stuff of litigation. They are not the stuff of basic human arrangements. For private property, as for other concepts, the vast range of cases outside litigation is well understood in terms of the basic legal conceptions. The long volumes written on what it, going to page 20, 24, what it means to possess land or chattels reveal the ambiguities in the word possession on which legal rights so often turn. May a bailee or a servant claim possession? How is possession lost by abandonment? Does an heir have constructive possession? Yet, through all the doctrinal murkiness, the settled legal rules make perfectly clear, more than 99.9% of the time, who, if anyone, possesses and owns anything. Vagueness and ambiguity are not fatal to the health of a legal system, any more than infection is necessarily fatal to the human body. In some cases, vagueness and ambiguity can kill, but in most cases, they do not. Lawyers can speak with precision about legal problems, even though language is vague and messy at the edges. To quote an old English maxim, just because there is twilight, it does not mean there is neither day nor night. Okay, that's the end of our time today. Through this chapter, the next a preview coming attraction here. The next section is called A Changing Constitution, question mark. And then we get into the issue of how this relates to constitutional interpretation. And we'll pick up there next time. So we went through pages 19 through 24 today, and we have 31 pages, so we'll do the rest next time. And I wanted to make sure we really honor Richard A. Epstein's labor in creating this book, Takings, Private Property and the Power of Eminent Domain, justly and appropriately published by Harvard University Press, 1985, which was 40 years ago. So this is the 40th anniversary celebrating the right of private property against the power of eminent domain when it's used perversely and it's not enforced against the government by the courts. Richard has a lovely heart for the flourishing of our community, and want to make sure he's on your radar as a worthy conversation partner. And I urge you to go pick up anything he's written and try to get it at a used bookstore. Support your local book dealer. Guys, you do not want bookstores to go away. That would be a disaster. And what I mean by books is books. I understand you like Amazon, and I, you know what? I have to be honest with you. I got this on Amazon. I hate the word. I hate the word. I hate saying I have to be honest with you. But I'm just letting you know that if you can find it, just be on the lookout for it, okay? And try to get it at your local book dealer. Let's give Amazon some competition and let's support our communities. Let's also be good examples for the young kids. Let them see you buying and reading books, books that you can hold in your hand, not books that are electronically basically controlled by some third party like Amazon Kindle. You don't want that. Okay. Let's be thoughtful about how we go into the future here with books. Thanks for joining me on the Republican Professor podcast. I've been your host, Dr. Lucas J. Mather. It is 30 July 2025, years after Jesus. It's a Wednesday. See ya. You want to turn the recording off there? Yeah, thanks, bud. Yeah. Okay, what do we got next? She's waiting right now. Oh. No. Send her in. Yeah, send her in. I got time. I got it.